You're listening to Everybody Pulls the Tarp, the go-to podcast for high performers. I'm Andrew Moses. Each week, you'll hear my thought-provoking conversations with Olympians, pro athletes, CEOs, elite coaches, best-selling authors, and other high performers to uncover their secrets to success. Get ready to be inspired each week when we talk about leadership, teamwork, work ethic, and more. Are you ready? Let's go. This week, my guest is Grammy-nominated singer and songwriter Sophie B. Hawkins. Over the course of her extraordinary career, Sophie has released 7 albums, including her acclaimed platinum-selling debut album from 1992, Tongues and Tails. The album features her iconic hit single, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, which spent 21 weeks on the Billboard Top 100 and peaked at number 6. Now, that song sure was a big one. All right, here's a quick clip. In addition to Damn, Sophie's mega hit As I Lay Me Down broke chart records and spent 44 weeks on the Billboard Top 100, ultimately peaking at number 5. Her songs have been featured in hit TV shows like Beverly Hills 90210, Dawson's Creek, and many more. And her latest album, Free Myself, was released in the spring of 2023. The conversation you are about to hear is a raw and candid look at Sophie's journey. She pulled back the curtain on many of the challenges and complex ideas that she's wrestled with through the years. And we dove deep into many of the moments and decisions that profoundly impacted her life. Sophie also shared an incredible behind-the-scenes look at how she wrote her breakout hit song, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, and why she believes it became such a massive success. Our conversation is filled with powerful lessons on finding inspiration, limiting distractions, the power of self-discovery, resisting conventional wisdom, and so much more. Simply put, Sophie is a trailblazer and always transcending boundaries. And this was a really thought-provoking conversation, and one I know I'll be reflecting on for a very long time. I hope you take away as much from this conversation as I did. So, let's pull the tarp and get straight to Sophie B. Hawkins. Where I want to go all the way back to your childhood. You discovered a passion for music at an early age. What is your first musical memory?
My first musical memory is the sounds of Manhattan. I loved listening to the sounds of Manhattan as I was napping, going to sleep, waking up, walking around. And still to me now, the sort of the bleats and the honks and the screeches, and then sometimes the incredible quiet, like there'll be a wave of noise and then there'll be a quiet, like the ocean, then a wave of noise. That is, for me, the most beautiful music. And then my family's voice, put that on top of it, and just life. And I always heard it as rhythmic, symphonic. So when I got to the first album, Tongues and Tails, I included all those sounds of the city as the orchestra in that album.
You just observe and hear these sounds of Manhattan, or did people in your life point out the sounds of Manhattan and say, listen to that, listen to this?
You know, it's interesting. As a mother, I go through this with my children, the decision-making of how much to say and how much to just let it be and be quiet. No one ever pointed anything out to me, and I loved it because everything that I discovered in my mind belonged to me. And I think that has helped very much in calming me as a human and making me self-directed. As I've grown in life, I feel grateful that nobody was pointing things out to me constantly. And I remember when I was pregnant with my children, one at a time, I would see other mothers, especially the first child. I'd watch other mothers or nannies, and I'd hear them constantly pointing out things to the children. And then the pediatrician would say, yeah, you're supposed to constantly point things out, constantly count, constantly verbalize, constantly this and that. And I was really torn because I thought I loved my quiet world where I got to choose how I saw things, what I wanted to make of things. My mother, by the way, is an artist. She's not alive now, but perhaps she respected the inner world so much that she didn't interrupt me all the time. Interruption is something that has become part of our society. You're interrupted by your phone all the time, apps, alarms, watch this, watch that, you know, emails saying, you know, it's time to do this. It's crazy. The whole thing of life is to not be interrupted.
What are some of the things that you do now to find that space to just listen and observe and avoid interruption?
Okay. Well, when I get up in the morning, and I was telling you before the interview, my son is really self-sufficient. So the most I can do is in the winter, say I get up with him, I make a fire, and he does all his own stuff, his own breakfast. But then when he walks out the door to catch his bus, I sit in front of the fire and I write in my journal. And I love that time, you know, in any season, in on tour, anywhere. I love the morning time of writing in my journal. And writing dreams, writing memories of the day before, the night, just writing everything down and processing it. And that always gets me wanting to start, whether I'm working on a song that day or my book that day, or I'm planning on going out and painting. It always gets me in the right frame of mind to protect my space. I have to say, I'm very protective of my time. And I always have been since I decided to be a musician. And I learned how to start practicing. I started to learn how to protect my time. And there's a lot of sacrifices I made when I was a teenager. When I say sacrifices, I mean when any human being decides they want to do one thing well, you have to decide other things are going to fall away, whether it's your social life, bad habits, fun habits that are not good for what the thing you want to do is. And you have to choose those things. And as a young person, you have to do that. And nobody really can make you do it in a way. It could be suggested, but you're doing it because you want to, or you have this greater desire. And it's really painful sometimes, you know, to make those sacrifices, even not doing family things, or like I said, cutting out lots of your social life, certainly not partying anymore, whatever, to become the person you want to become as an artist or an athlete or whatever. So that same protection of my time and the cutting out of this, cutting the fat off of life, so to speak, is endemic in me. I trained myself, as we all do. And then now at this age, it's the greatest gift. Everything I did that was hard before is the greatest gift now. When people, great friends who are like family, when they try to interrupt my time, I am so clear. I'm almost deadly. That you cannot come in here now. You cannot interrupt this time. Virginia Woolf had a skull and crossbones on her door or something. Like, do not open this door. You have to be that way.
Is there a moment early in your career where you began to realize the enormity of the sacrifices that you would have to make to achieve the success that you've achieved and continue to achieve? Was there like a moment that you can remember, a particular sacrifice, a particular decision that you made? Talk about that for a moment.
Well, it was smaller moments along the road, and I made decisions. And then later on, I wondered if I should have not made those decisions. But I did. I made these decisions to not do a certain amount of self-promotion, even before internet. I protected my time as a songwriter. And, you know, I think, and also I wanted to write alone. These tiny decisions. I always wrote all my music alone. I played so many of the instruments on the albums because I made my own demos. And since I had begun that way and sort of fallen in love with the process of that, I am going to record my own songs on any system I can. I'm going to learn it. I'm going to play all the instruments. I'm going to learn all these instruments, and I'm going to record my songs alone. I was a little bit before a lot of people. Now it might be more normal. But then it was very unusual for a female, young female in New York to just say, I'm doing this all myself. And I did it. And then when I got my record deal, I heard that people had wrote reviews like, she, it seems like it's not her first record. It can't be. Well, it wasn't my first recording. I'd been recording for years, you know, whether it was on those cassettes, the Tascams, then going to reel to reel DVDs we used to record on, you know, the VHSs. I learned every single possible medium to get my music where I wanted it to be. So these decisions also kept me in my own kind of box, because I didn't want to go out into the world and say, help me, help me, help me write a song, help me get a hit. I wanted to do that myself. And that takes time, and it takes fighting for what you believe. And a lot of times the industry says, oh, the hell with you. You know, we want to have a hit now. We don't want to wait. We don't want to see what your next album is about. And if it's not like the first album, we're not interested. So these decisions were all along. Every single decision I made, to be honest with you, was to be an artist and to not be a pop star. And the fact that I remained a pop star is shocking, because, and it just speaks to how much the fans loved my music and still support me, because the industry was like, what? Why don't you do more in the industry and do less of your own sort of making?
Do you remember, like, I know I just asked you to try and recall a moment where you realized you were making a sacrifice, and maybe part of this is a sacrifice as well. Was there a moment where you realized that kind of this idea of becoming a pop star was happening, even though you had kind of set out to intentionally not do it that way? Like what do you remember about that moment?
Well, I think I did want to be recognized, and I did want to be a star. I didn't know there was such a word called a pop star, because maybe there wasn't as much that word when I was first making my demos. But when I was called a pop star, I hated it. And when I'm called a pop star now, I hate it. Only because I think of pop stars as people who say, make me. So I made a lot of mistakes also in then the struggle of not be wanting to be a pop star, because I write all my music and I'm so diverse in my writing, but then feeling I have to do these things to be famous, to keep the record company happy, to keep the support coming. And then I would blunder and make horrible mistakes and misrepresent myself. In a way, I didn't have the steady vision of how to combine the two. So yeah, I guess when you say, was there a moment I decided? I think the moments I decided were reactions to horrible things that happened in my career, where I was humiliated because I had allowed people in too much. And by the way, even now I look back and I go, why did I show that much? Why did I do that? There was no point to doing that. It didn't help my career, and it certainly hurt me as a person. So those things, they're continual.
And when those moments happen in the moment, you talked about it being reactionary. How did you respond? I mean, in some instances, you just indicated that maybe the response is certainly something you would have done something differently had you had the opportunity to do it again. What do you remember most about, like, kind of your response in those moments to some of those situations?
Well, I went inward and I, of course, beat myself up, and I was solitary. And I didn't talk to anybody about it. And I didn't seek advice or comfort. I just wrote songs and tried to create my world again from my piano outward, basically. It was terrible how lonely it is anyway to be a person in the spotlight. It is lonely because everyone expects something of you. Even if they expect to hate you or they expect to love you, they expect something of you. And they expect what they have envisioned. And there's no way you feel that from people if you're empathetic, like I am, and sensitive, and you want them to see you as you are. But even at a certain point, you can't see yourself as you are because everyone's looking at you saying, fulfill this, fulfill that. So the loneliness is that you go inward and have to protect yourself.
Where do you think your empathy, your deep, deep empathy comes from? And is it something that you think you were born with, or you think that developed over time?
That's a really great question. As a mother, I wonder that, raising children, because I can see that my children, for instance, are very sensitive and empathetic. Also, I can see how each child in a different way protects themselves from being hurt and sometimes may seem less empathetic than I actually know they are. So I see the social thing, like where someone will say, why is that child not responding in the proper way? And I think that child feels it so deeply, that child will not show the world what that child feels because it's too painful. So empathy is something that I think probably most people are born with. And I think what happens is we get so hurt, probably. This is not a theory. I haven't thought about this. You asked me. For me, my empathy was for my immediate family, everyone. I remember everyone I met, I felt so sensitively toward, and I thought was a really good person, and I wanted to help that person. That was a feeling I've always had, that everyone I met. And then I gravitated towards the empathetic heroes like Martin Luther King and all the heroes of the civil rights movement. They were empathetic. They were sensitive. They wanted to help people. These were always my heroes. I never, ever gravitated towards the powerful people. And that's something that may have also been in our society at the time. I was born into the civil rights movement, 64.
What was it about leaders like Martin Luther King and other civil rights leaders that you felt particularly drawn to?
Well, again, it's his sensitivity and his strength and his willingness to, it actually makes me cry because there's nobody like this anymore. His willingness to completely sacrifice his life to help people who really deserved to be helped and needed the help. You couldn't pass the buck any longer. You couldn't wait any longer. And it's not to say that he was the only one, by far he's not. And I forget all the names. I remember them and then I forget them. But all the people before Rosa Parks who decided not to go to the back of the bus, all the people who made those steps, he was aware of them and he culminated all that energy and all that pain. And it's being able to turn, it's like the thing of Jesus, and not to say this holy Christian thing, but the thing that I love most about Jesus as a symbol, whether Jesus existed or not, I have no idea. But what I love about the message is, this is a human being who was the most betrayed of any person ever, killed by his own friends and in such a violent way in front of everyone. He was born into this world to suffer, really, and to give this message of love and to feel all this love and then to be betrayed by your closest people and killed in this way and to all through it, to never veer from the message of, you have to love each other as you wish to be loved. You have to do unto others as you wish to be done unto. What a phenomenal message. And to forgive. And I don't even think any of us really understand what forgiveness is. And when someone said it's about, not about the other person, it's about being able to live with the betrayals and the traumas and the crimes against you. It's about yourself. Possibly that's what true forgiveness is. But whatever it is, that message, that Martin Luther King, to take all the pain and the betrayals of being human and to turn it into loving each other. It's just phenomenal.
Do you believe that your extraordinary creative ability is richer when you're coming from a place of anger, of sadness, of disappointment, or coming from a place of happiness and empowerment? Do you feel a difference in your creative flow?
That's a beautiful question. I think that they actually are so connected. And it's like when you look at the ocean and you see this ocean is this passionate, unknown quantity with all these colors and it goes so deep, we don't even know. But then you see the light on top, the light dancing on the water, and you could never really, it changes all the time. I think that's what it is, creativity. It's all of it at once. And if you're too dark and sad, it would be impossible. If you're too deep, for instance, in the ocean, it's impossible to get up and get the breath and create. But if you're too light and you stay on the surface, you can never get to the substance. So for me, like, it makes me happy to recognize the sadness and the pain, and that I'm here with my dog right here And this gives me happiness and the sense that after this interview, I can create even one great sentence. Well, that's even a lot to ask. You know, one great thought is amazing, happy. And then something else sad is a constant between. I think we have to hold the rope at all points, at all the time, and let it. And the thing is to not control it and to not try to be happy and don't try to be sad.
I'm curious, when you think about your creative process, and I want to get into some of your hits that everybody knows. Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover, which was a mega hit and earned you a Grammy nominee for Best New Artist. When you think back on that song in particular and writing that song, did you know at the moment that it could be kind of a breakout hit for you? Or did it just feel like everything else that you had worked on?
I completely knew that Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover was different. And I knew it pretty soon as it was coming out. And it was terrifying because, you know, when I used to wish on a star, you know, when I was 9, I wished for a yellow bicycle with a banana seat. Now I'm wishing for to write a great song, one great song. And then I knew it was coming out and it was so scary. And it was also so exhilarating. It's the same thing we said about happiness and sadness. I wanted to just stop and allow it, but yet I had to work on it and create it. It's really something. And I lived with it a while before anyone else said, you know, that's a really great song. And in fact, the very first person who heard the very first demo did not respond to it. And maybe the second person said, oh man, like sort of a little bit of jealousy and who's that about and whatever. It took a while for someone actually to hear it and say, this is a huge hit. And when that person said it, I said, I know, this is my big one. This is my introduction into the world. And after all the hundreds of songs I've written, it felt completely different.
Why do you think that song has continued to resonate with people for so long?
Because it's the complexity of it. Because it's not just, damn, I wish I was your lover, or damn. It's everything that follows it. It's that you can have that simple thing, but it's after this really complicated verse and these gorgeous chords. You can't manufacture that. It has to come from a life of love and pain and curiosity and exploration and going to the depths and being in the heights. It has to come from a human being. AI can't create stuff like this. It's a combination of my jazz, my rock, my pop, my single individual life of struggle with my parents and everything. It's just New York, all of it. It's everything right there in that song. And you can analyze every part of it. And there's a story. There's a story in the chord changes in the verse. There's a story in how every verse is a different length and every verse has a different melody and every verse has different. I mean, I'm saying chorus now. Of course, that's the same in the verse, but every verse is different and every chorus is different. And that doesn't happen now. And the bridge is 16 bars. And then there's a third verse thrown in to tell the story even more. It's unusual as AF, they say.
Unusual AF, as they say.
Yes.
So, Sophie, I have had the good fortune of interviewing Sony from Hootie and the Blowfish twice. Sony is the drummer in Hootie and the Blowfish. And he tells a story when Hootie and the Blowfish had their breakout hit, Cracked Rear View, an album that is one of the top-selling albums of all time, essentially launched them to stardom. He tells a story of Darius Rucker sitting down with the band and saying, you know, guys, we are probably never going to top this. And it was this moment of realization. And it's funny to look back on, given what Darius Rucker has accomplished since then as a solo artist and what Hootie and the Blowfish has gone on to continue to accomplish. But I'm curious, did you have a moment like that where all the success that you had been dreaming about, becoming a star as you described, happened?
Yeah, but
did you have a concern that you couldn't top it?
No. Well, at the time, Damn, I Wish I Was Your Lover came out on the album Tongues and Tails, I didn't think it was good enough. I didn't think it lived up to the actual song. And the moment where I thought I'll never top it came much later. It came recently, when I was going back out on this tour for Free Myself, but we kind of dubbed the beginning of that tour a Tongues and Tails anniversary because it was a Tongues and Tails anniversary. And I was learning all the Tongues and Tails songs. And I think I told my friend, I can't ever top this. I never knew it was this good. And I've gone on to make these 7 albums and I've never topped this album. So that was a moment, like, you know, 30 years later, I had that moment.
You didn't realize until 30 years later just how good it was.
No, I didn't. Because as you pointed out before you started recording, I'm always doing new things. And when you're always doing new things, you don't really recognize what you've done. And there, to me, that's me. That's sort of the beauty. People sometimes remind me, don't get so hard on yourself. Look what you've done. And I go, what? What have I done?
What have I done? You've done a ton.
But that's the difference between females and males' psyche, I think, because males are very aware of achievements, much more than females are aware of achievements. Females are always, biologically, we just have to keep creating, keep moving. It's much different from us. And I think the male psyche, perhaps, I know this is broad strokes, but I have a son and a daughter, and I can see the difference. The daughter is never satisfied with what she does. And she so instantly goes into self-depreciation. And I'm like, oh my God, how did this happen? I thought I was raising her to love herself, have confidence. It doesn't matter. The female psyche is just never going to be satisfied with what they do, no matter how great it is. The males can go, yeah, I did that. I'm going to celebrate.
You know what? It's interesting to look at. I have 2 young girls, and it's something that I'm mindful of. And I think the points you make there are so important. I think it's so important. And in particular, to really understand and think deeply about how the people around us behave and what they need to be and feel supported, I think is so important, regardless of kind of what their attributes or disposition are. Sophie, I'm curious about your live performances. So your live performances, people describe as absolutely spellbinding. You bridge the gap between audience and performer like very few performing artists can do. Have you always connected so well with live audiences? And regardless of whether or not you always have, or it's something that you've gotten better at, what is it that enables you to connect so well with audiences?
I don't know. I think that I probably always had that thing. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I feel when I walk on the stage, this incredible joy at the people there. I always say, I don't know if there's ever been just one person in the audience, but even if there were, I would give them that 1,000% show because I'm so grateful they're there. There's that. And there's this funny thing about being human that on stage, I can really be my full self, my wacky full self. And I think that I give myself total permission to do that. I don't know why. I don't have the sense that I'm a performer, in quotes. I have a sense that I've got, that I'm using the music and the songs to get people and myself to another place, another level. And that's when I get off stage, I feel like, wow, I got to another level. I'm so happy. I used to feel if I didn't get to another level, then I was a failure. But then I realized, no, that's not true. Stop judging. That's the only thing between you and complete ecstasy is your judgment. So I've worked on that. And I'll give you an example. There was a show I had, and it was about 3 years ago. I was in the Midwest. I was in Milwaukee. And it was like a theater. It was like 300 seats. And there was a woman in the front. And I was just solo. And the whole show, I thought she was judging me. I thought she was looking at my fingers on the guitar, my fingers on the piano, and listening to every note and thinking whether I was in tune or whether I was messing up. And then 2/3 through the show, and it was killing me. My head was just going nuts with this. I would enjoy this show so much if that woman would stop judging me. I would love this show, and I would leave my body, and then I would remember the judge. You know what happened to me? 2/3 of the show, I realized that woman was my biggest fan and she wasn't judging me. She was in love with everything I was doing. She loved my fingers on the guitar. She didn't know that I was messing up. She didn't care whether I was out of tune. And when I realized that I was completely projecting my inner judge on this poor, fabulous woman, it changed my life. By the way, that happened on stage. So why I might be so good on stage is that I allow for all these things to happen on stage in the moment.
You can observe. I mean, you can look and see someone's eyes and create that type of story in your mind as to what one person in an audience is thinking or contemplating.
Yeah. And that, like I said, but the takeaway was that I was projecting onto her this horrible, mean judge in my head. And the lady wasn't at all. She was literally in the front row because she waited to see me probably for years. I hadn't been to that town. You understand what I mean? It's like a double-edged story because it showed me how much I project all my negative feelings on people as they look at me. And then it also showed me that I could switch it by realizing how much I'm loved. And again, so yes, I can, of course. Yes.
When you said it changed your life, is it now that you're able to kind of remember that night in Milwaukee and say, you know what, I'm going to project less on people, or I'm going to assume positive intent? Like, talk about how it's changed your life.
Yes, it was the beginning of a whole new outlook where I realized that all these people who I thought didn't like me and thought I was terrible musician, maybe, well, in my present life, possibly and probably, they have none of those negative feelings and that I'm burdening myself with them. So every time I had this sense that nobody really wants to come to my show, no, I would stop it and I would say whatever I would say to realize what could possibly be the truth. And then eventually it went away. I had to exercise it, though, constantly. And I'm not saying those negative feelings ran my life, because the fact that I was aware of it on stage that moment meant that it was at the beginning of the end, if you know what I mean. The problem is when we're not aware of it. And that's when we wouldn't notice that it was a projection. So yes, I was able to turn it around and I was able to question, why do I think someone is my closest friends? Why do I think that they're looking at me with anger? They're probably not. And so I started to assume they were not, and I started to realize, oh, they weren't. It was just me or the voices in my head, whatever, my past.
Sophie, as we get ready to wrap up our conversation, you've been so generous with your time. I could ask you millions of questions and spend hours talking to you about all this. But as we get ready to wrap up our conversation, I'm curious, looking back on it all so far, because you're still writing many, many new chapters in the Sophie B. Hawkins story.
Yes.
Is there one thing that you would point to most that's kind of powered your success?
Well, I have to be candid and say that I don't view myself as successful. I view myself as a person who's been able to support myself and be the artist that I really want to be, of course, with a lot of pitfalls and mistakes. And I'm really grateful that I can do that. To me, successful would be that, I guess, when I'm 85 or 90 and I've been able to continue to do this, and when my past work, which includes my work now, is still supporting me, I would say that is really successful. And also my children loving me and wanting me in their life. And as if they have children and they want me to babysit the grandchildren and be next to them, these are all things that will make me feel I've had a really successful life. But as far as, so to answer the question, what has powered the amount of energy I can put into my work? That is just love of what I'm doing. And I say that to my son, because he's going through this whole thing of having to get ready to get accepted to college and all this BS that the kids have to go through now, getting perfect grades, getting perfect scores, get whatever, blah, blah, blah. It's so traumatizing in a way, because it has nothing to do with what happens after college. What I say to my son, look, all I want you to do is to wake up every morning and love what you have to do. And for me, I can say I wake up really excited to write in my journal and get going on the creative project I have that day. I always am excited about it. So that, I guess, is that's it's love of what I'm doing and love of how I'm doing it and love of the people around me. If that's success, I have it.
Well, the love and the enthusiasm that you have for what you do and the people around you and the people who love you pours out of you, Sophie B. Hawkins. There is no question that you're leading with all those things, and the enthusiasm and the joy that all this brings you and still brings you is just really inspiring. I mean, honestly, it's inspiring to sit down and talk to you about it. And I know so many listening are going to share that inspiration and enthusiasm.
Well, you're really kind, and I appreciate your time, and I appreciate that you had to go through so much technical stuff. And this dog, by the way, is 20 years old. His name is Sailor. And he's an inspiration too, because he died and he drowned. And I gave him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation for 20 minutes and brought him back to life. And I guess that's also a symbol, is never give up. It took 20 minutes to revive him because he was dead. His eyes were rolled back. Everything was coming out of his body. And I just kept squeezing his ribs, giving him mouth-to-mouth resuscitation and screaming at him to come back. And he did. And he's lived 5 years after that.
Wow. And he's such a beautiful dog. He's been sitting there on your lap for the vast majority of our conversation. What a beautiful, kind dog you have there. And he is as thankful as it gets for you pushing hard that 20 minutes and not giving up, as you said.
Don't ever give up on yourself, and don't give up on your loved ones and your work. That's what I want to tell you.
That's an important message for us to wrap up our conversation today. Sophie B. Hawkins, thank you so much for joining me today. You are forever a part of the Everybody Pulls the Tarp community, and I hope we can do this again sometime, because you're constantly pushing the envelope, constantly challenging the status quo, and I can't wait to see where you continue to go as you write new chapters in the Sophie B. Hawkins story. Thank you so much for spending time with me today.
Thank you.
All right, everyone. If you loved this episode, you might also enjoy my interview with Hootie and the Blowfish drummer and two-time Grammy Award winner, Jim Sonnefeld. In 1989, Jim and bandmates Mark Bryan, Dean Felber, and Darius Rucker were playing gigs at small bars and fraternity parties at the University of South Carolina. They booked their own gigs, hung up posters to promote their shows, and scraped money together to reserve time at local recording studios. Ultimately, they'd go on to achieve massive success, winning 2 Grammy Awards and selling over 25 million albums worldwide. Jim's story is remarkable, and this is another episode you don't want to miss. Check it out and let me know what you think. Thank you for joining me this week. Be sure to subscribe in your favorite podcast app so you can catch all of our upcoming episodes. And if you are like me and want a world full of tarp pullers, then leave a review to help others find us. You can also follow me on Twitter at Andrew H. Moses. That's Andrew H. Moses. And be sure to sign up for my email newsletter at everybodypullsthetarp.com/newsletter. I'll share tips and insights to help you achieve maximum success and happiness. Today is a great day to pull the tarp. I am rooting for you. See you next time.